Hello, this is Florence Nash from Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Modern Maturity. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And for the next half hour, I'm going to be reading to you, first of all, from the Carolina Arts and Sciences magazine, which is a publication of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Got an interesting article in here titled Science, Spirituality, and Synergy in Nepal. In a three-week journey from Chapel Hill to the Himalayas to study the effects of climate change on Buddhist holy lakes, two mathematicians, a marine scientist, and a religious studies scholar overcame multiple challenges and proved the value of an interdisciplinary team. There's a quote here at the beginning from Sir Edmund Hillary, who was the first climber, along with the Sherpa Tenzing Norgay, ever to reach the summit of Mount Everest. He said, "It is not the mountains that we conquer, but ourselves." Mathematics Department Chair Rich McLaughlin begins the interview this way. "Let me give you the 20,000-foot view of this trip, the highlights and the headaches." It's an appropriate analogy, given that he has just returned from a spring 2018 trip to the Gokyo Lakes in Nepal, the highest freshwater lakes in the world, at an elevation of about 15,000 feet. They are in Sagarmatha National Park, a protected area in the Himalayas that is dominated by Mount Everest. It was an expedition 2 years in the making when McLaughlin first ran into Lauren Lev, an associate professor of religious studies and an anthropologist at a Carrborough restaurant. McLaughlin and Keenan Distinguished Professor of Mathematics Roberto Camassa, experts in fluid dynamics, were interested in studying the effects of climate change on pristine high-altitude lakes. How are melting glaciers modifying the physical and biological properties of these lakes, which are sacred to the Buddhist tradition? Lev, an expert in Himalayan Buddhism, has spent 28 years conducting research in Nepal. They started talking and agreed, wouldn't it be fun if we could work on a project together? They asked Marine Sciences Professor Harvey Syme, whose fieldwork spans the North Carolina coast to the Galapagos, to join the team. They received financial support through the Fostering Interdisciplinary Research Explorations, or FIRE, grant. The awards program, funded by the Office of the Vice Chancellor for Research and the Institute for the Arts and Humanities, is now called the Arts and Humanities Research Grant. The airlines lost our instruments. We departed for the trek with only half of our scientific equipment. It was later found and delivered to us on the third day of the hike, but it was damaged, McLaughlin said. Then, to make things more interesting, even though we had acquired the scientific permits ahead of time, once we arrived, there was a skirmish between the local municipality, the federal government, and the national park. They could not agree about us taking a boat out on the lakes. McLaughlin was also battling knee problems, although cortisone shots, braces, and hiking poles helped. In addition, he has a fear of heights, yet had to cross six suspension bridges about 1,000 feet high to reach the group's final destination. Fans of Indiana Jones's bridge battle in the Temple of Doom may appreciate the mental picture this conjures. After the team returned to the United States, they had to wait 2 weeks for two bags containing important scientific equipment and water samples to clear customs. A scientific and spiritual expedition. After leaving Raleigh-Durham International Airport, four flights, 40 hours, and almost 8,000 miles later, the UNC team arrived at Tenzing Hillary Airport in Lukla by way of Kathmandu. The tiny airport in eastern Nepal is named for Sir Edmund Hillary and Sherpa guide Tenzing Norgay, who were the first to summit Mount Everest. It is the point where most people begin the climb to Mount Everest base camp, and it was the starting point for the team's trek. Condé Nast Traveler called it one of the most dangerous airports in the world, due to its short one-way and steep drop-off, high elevation at nearly 9,500 feet, and unpredictable winds and weather. Accompanied by a national park apprentice, Sherpas, and guides, It took them 6 days, including one day of rest and acclimation, to hike to the Gokyo Lakes at a pace of about 10 miles per day. In addition to supplies and scientific equipment, they lugged a large inflatable raft they hoped to float on the lakes. There are 6 main lakes, and the UNC team planned to study 3 of them. The Himalayas serve as the source of drinking water for 800 million people, and that statistic hit home for Syme. The Gokyo Lakes are also an internationally recognized Ramsar site by UNESCO, meaning they are protected wetlands for waterfowl. The Gokyo Lakes lie next to Ingozumba Glacier, the largest glacier in Nepal, yet it's unclear whether they are fed by that glacier, said Syme, who faced bouts of altitude sickness during the trip. So one of the biggest questions we were trying to understand is the lake's water source. As the glaciers melt, they can create glacial lake outburst floods, or GLOFs, one of the most hazardous impacts of climate change, and that can cause flooding of settlements downstream. Understanding what's happening in this one remote corner of the world can offer lessons for global warming in other places, Kamasa said. It's like a fast-forward movie of what's happening with climate change everywhere, he said. The lakes are also extremely important to the Buddhist faith. Lev laid the groundwork for interviewing local people about their understanding of the impacts of climate change. She also became a critical cultural translator when the group ran into major roadblocks days into the research expedition. Negotiating with the competing parties involved in granting research permissions fell right in line with her research, which looks at religion as a window into understanding cultural change. The Khumbu region, where the Gokyo Lakes lie, is the ancestral home of the Sherpa people, who are known for their Buddhist piety as well as their skill as mountain guides. For Himalayan Buddhists, the physical environment is occupied by a variety of supernatural creatures who inhabit the natural landscape and protect the people. Their presence renders the earth itself sacred, and the particular sites where they live, like mountains and lakes, are carefully protected. Purity is very important there, Lev said. While putting a boat on the lake was not seen as actively immoral, it was certainly not traditional behavior. We were asking to do something that required bringing the secular and scientific into a very sacred domain. To add to the complexity of the issue, Nepal is also undergoing a political transformation to a more democratic form of government, and local people are being encouraged to exercise their indigenous rights. The fact that local people were actually demanding to be at the table and have their values respected was a good thing, she said. It's a conversation that needs to be happening. After some intense discussions, the researchers were allowed to do research on Lakes 2, 3, and 4, but they agreed not to take a boat on Lake 3, the holiest of the lakes. Before they went out on 2 of the lakes, they performed a Buddhist ceremony, puja, where they asked the resident deities for forgiveness for infringing on the sacred space and promised that their intentions were good. It was a very scientific journey, but it became very spiritual too, McLaughlin said. It was eye-opening and humbling. Making measurements. Syme is an experienced field scientist and oceanographer who is adept at problem-solving on the fly. Still, he conducts most of his research on a motorized boat, not an inflatable raft. We had been warned that the winds could get strong, and they did, said Syme. During the trip, the group endured rain, snow, heavy fog, and unpredictable weather. At times, we had to have people paddling while we were trying to stay in place because the anchor wasn't holding. The group used a variety of scientific tools to collect important data on the lakes, including an echo sounder to measure depth of the lakes, an acoustic Doppler current profiler, or ADCP, to measure water currents and internal waves, a special profiler designed in the UNC Fluids Lab by the team, UNC undergraduate Matthew Hurley, lab manager Jim Mahaney, and postdoctoral fellow Pierre-Yves Passagia, to measure temperature, conductivity, pressure, and turbidity. thermistors to measure lake temperature and pressure at different depths, a water sampler to collect inflow-outflow samples. One of the more dramatic immediate findings was from Lake 4. Kathmandu University researcher Subodh Sharma had measured its depth at 62 meters in 2009. The UNC team measured it at 45 meters. Sharma, a professor in the Department of Environmental Sciences and Engineering, had visited UNC last April to share his research. "This giant lake has drained substantially," McLaughlin said. After multiple attempts, including battling an anchor line that was tangled up with the instruments, a series of thermistors was deployed on Lake 4. They will remain in place for about 15 months, taking measurements every 15 minutes. The value of the interdisciplinary team. In summing up the challenges that they ultimately overcame, Lev puts it simply, "It was kind of a disaster, but a beautiful disaster. None of us could have done this alone. It was far more valuable in the end, facing the challenges that we did," Lev said. "What we encountered was an amazing case study in the ways that religion and politics and government and science are fundamentally interwoven. It allowed us to look at the ways people are actually making choices and creating meaning in their everyday lives around the issue of climate change." McLaughlin admitted that he would not have believed before their journey that what they had put in a grant proposal, the value of an interdisciplinary team, would have been so essential. "We went halfway around the world, built all of these instruments, then found out there was a very good chance we might not be able to do the research," he said. "It was absolutely the case where the team was greater than the sum of the individual parts." The political dynamics of interacting with the locals and the Park Service were familiar to Syme, given his experiences on the North Carolina coast and in the Galapagos, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. "I think it's a common issue, and I know various groups are interested in the convergence of natural and social sciences," Syme said. "Despite the challenges it presented while we were there, I think it presents opportunities for moving forward." Kamasa, who is from Milan, grew up hiking and climbing in the Alps. Seeing this part of the world was a dream come true for him. He praised the adaptability, flexibility, and strength of the diverse UNC team. "We got along so well, and Lauren was instrumental in getting our thoughts across in Nepali, he said. "I think our interdisciplinary team really saved the expedition." On the trek back to Lukla, the researchers gave a presentation to the National Park Service and shared what they were able to accomplish. They also hosted a dinner party for local representatives and park officials. Continuing the journey. Now that the UNC crew is back home, they are expanding their interdisciplinary team. Jay Cable, professor and chair of the new Environment, Ecology, and Energy Program, E3P, will be working with Syme to analyze the collected samples to determine the lake's water source and to get a better picture of the interconnectivity of the water basins. The team will return to the Himalayas in fall 2019 to retrieve the thermistors and learn how the water level of the lake varied in the 15 months since their initial visit. They hope that the instruments will survive two monsoon seasons and freezing temperatures. They will likely wait to publish their results until they gather the 2019 data and have a more complete picture. Meanwhile, they are trying to raise money to support math and science education in a primary school founded by their Nepal Trek senior guide, Deep Rai, in the rural village where he grew up. And Lev will be working with community leaders and the National Park Service in Nepal to help them develop a set of best practices for future researchers. "This will be our legacy, a gift that will affect all researchers going forward so that their work can be done in a more culturally respectful way," she said. The UNC team also asked the local people what they most cared about in terms of protecting the lakes, and water quality surfaced as a top issue. They will be reaching out to other experts at UNC to see if they can help with this. The approach of conducting research with, rather than on, communities is important to Lev, who previously helped develop an interdisciplinary UNC graduate certificate in participatory research. Our Nepal project became a meaningful collective inquiry, she said. As the university thinks about its mission of serving people in the world, this is a great example of what can be done. And now, bouncing off that inspiring article, let's go to the AARP Bulletin for April and look at an article under the rubric of Your Life called Citizen Science. Across the U.S., volunteers collect vital data for research projects. Older folks tend to have spare time and a desire to stay socially connected, says Darlene Cavalier of SciStarter. They enjoy being part of a process that advances science. So here are some examples of senior people who have also joined the quest for vital data and research. First of all, we have Mary White, 67, photographing flowers. White hunches over a table, aiming her camera at a sprig of wildflowers on a velvet cloth. She snaps photos in natural light, then darkens the room and shoots under an ultraviolet light. The petals appear to change color with spots that glow. Not only are these photos captivating, but they can help researchers better understand how butterflies, bees, and other pollinators are attracted to various kinds of plants. White, an amateur photographer from Port St. Louis, Florida, took up this pursuit a few years ago through Florida's Master Naturalist program at her local extension office. You get to know yourself through nature, she says. You also connect with the world and become a force in preserving it for our children. And then we have Larry Fizz, age 60, watching the clouds. Fizz of Pottstown, Pennsylvania, is an engineering consultant in the pharmaceutical industry. On lunch breaks, he helps NASA with satellites capture images of the tops of clouds, but scientists need data from a ground perspective, too. I'm just a regular guy who goes out to make observations, snap some photos, and complete an online form, Fizz says. I feel that in my own little way, I'm helping quantify how human activities affect the environment. Here's a little box that says, be a citizen scientist. To find a citizen science project in your area, go to these websites, scistarter.com, that's SciStarter.com, Zooniverse, ZOONIVERSE.org, citizenscience.gov. Your local library can also be a good resource. Omega R. and Brenda A. Wilson, 69-year-olds from Mebane, North Carolina, organized residents to collect water samples through a project with the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. That effort led to federal grants to mitigate contamination in our community, Omega says. Citizen science addresses issues of human beings in their environment. Next, we've got the Thursday Tree Huggers, monitoring plants. This group of people, all in their 70s and 80s, monitors seasonal changes in plants, such as bud breaks and unfolding leaves, at the New York Botanical Garden in the Bronx. Each tree is like an adventure because they do all of these things, but at different times, says Sandy Walkenberg, 77, a retired preschool teacher. Their observations may help scientists monitor the effects of climate change. It's been a life-changing experience for me because it's allowed me to connect with nature and my fellow tree huggers in such a meaningful way. And then Paige Dabney, age 68. Testing water. Dabney is a financial advisor and outdoor enthusiast from Bozeman, Montana, who volunteers through a group called Adventure Scientists. He has collected water samples for a study on microplastic pollution. One site was 3.5 miles into Yellowstone National Park with 3 feet of snow on the ground, and it was 12 degrees. We went in on snowshoes and cross-country skis, and I had to crack through the ice with a hatchet to get the sample. He also has chased and cataloged butterflies for a study on pollinators and will be taking tree core samples for research on important species. And another sidebar to the article here says, sure, it's all fun and games until someone gets helped. Your contribution to science may be just a mouse click away. Every puzzle that Marilyn Conover Watt solves advances science. The 66-year-old retired occupational therapist spends time examining images on a screen in a game called Mozaic. That's it, Mozaic, M-O-Z-A-K dot science. With a mouse, she magnifies an image and traces parts of neurons to score points. It may be fun, but it also helps scientists build models of brain cells. It feels good. It feels like I'm really adding something. It beats playing Mario, Watt says. Although, I don't know, I love Mario. Think amateur science involves only counting birds or measuring rainfall? Many scientists are incorporating their research into games and puzzles. The scale of creative humans working on problems dwarfs what my lab can do, says Riju Das, an associate professor of biochemistry at Stanford University. Das has more than 150,000 players helping to design molecules for tuberculosis diagnostics through Eterna. And that website is Eterna Game, eternagame.org. Here are two other free citizen science games to try. Fold It. Launched by the University of Washington in 2008, Fold It asks players to figure out how a given protein folds or determine how to design novel proteins. This can help scientists understand what jobs a protein does, how to fix a misfolded one, or even to how to develop new medicines. And that's at fold.it. Eyewear. Players of this brain mapping game, developed by Princeton University's Sebastian Seung Computational Neuroscience Lab, have reconstructed more than 3,000 neurons and discovered at least 6 new types of neurons. And that is at iWire, E-Y-E-W-I-R-E, dot org. Now, on the topic of people working collaboratively to get things done, here, back in the AARP Bulletin, is a Q&A with Melinda Gates. And the heading is, When Women Lock Arms at Whatever Level in Society, They Can Change the World. How the co-founder of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation discovered that empowering women was the key to transforming global society. And this is from an interview by Hugh Delahanty. And he starts off, what was your biggest misconception when you started your foundation? She says that if we had a breakthrough, a new vaccine, a new contraceptive, a new seed, and we got it into the supply chain, it would reach men and women equally. That turned out to be a very false assumption. Even if a country's government says it wants to deliver these tools, few actually make it into the hands of women. In your book, The Moment of Lift, you write about a heart-rending encounter you had with a young woman in northern India. Was that an aha moment for you? Meena was a woman I met at a health facility we'd helped fund. She'd recently given birth, and we had a warm conversation, mother to mother, about bonding with a new baby. But when I asked if she planned to have more children, she said, The truth is, no, I don't know how I'm going to feed this child. I don't have any hope of educating him. The only hope I have for this child's future is for you to take him home with you. The conversation crushed me. I had to tell her, I'm so sorry, I can't. I started digging and learned that more than 200 million women in developing countries wanted access to contraceptives but didn't have it. Your global campaign to give contraceptives to 120 million women by 2020 has made you unpopular in some places. I'm a practicing Catholic, but I really had to follow my conscience on this one. I was seeing so much death in the developing world. I would go out and get 60 women in a village together and ask them to raise their hands if they knew of someone who had lost a child in childbirth. Every single hand would go up. The lack of contraceptives and having children too soon and too often was causing an immense amount of misery. Hans Rosling, an expert on international health, once told you, American billionaires giving away money will mess everything up. How do you avoid that? He advised me to always go to the margins of society. He taught me that I needed to go out and talk to women and understand, with data, where they were being held back on a societal level. That's not just a developing world issue, is it? Correct. I remember looking a few years back at how far women had actually come in the United States. I thought we were fully empowered, but less than 5% of the Fortune 500 CEOs were women. And when I went through each industry systematically, I realized we still had a long way to go. What steps have you and Bill taken to make your marriage more equitable? When I got pregnant with our first child, I surprised Bill by saying that I wanted to leave my job to stay home with the baby. We fell into pretty traditional gender roles, but over time we've gotten more intentional about making our partnership a truly equal one. At the beginning, I was happy for Bill to be the public face of the foundation. I realized later that it was important to me that I was seen as his equal there. There were moments when that took a little push, but for the most part, I've had Bill's support. He's a data geek, so he's seen the research that says equal partnerships tend to be happier ones. How about in the Gates household? We all do the dishes together after dinner, but one night I was still in the kitchen 15 minutes after everyone else had dwindled away, and I thought, this isn't right. So the next night when people started to drift off, I put my hands on my hips and said, maybe not in the most elegant way, nobody leaves this kitchen until I leave the kitchen. Bill and the kids gave me this surprised look. I said, look, after you guys leave, I'm still doing X, Y, and Z. Guess what? Everything I did in 15 minutes got done by all of us in 5 minutes. You've struggled with perfectionism. It took me half a century on this earth, but I finally had an epiphany that my best self was not my most polished self. I think I'm actually a better version of myself when I'm willing to role model for others that all of us are imperfect and flawed. What did you learn from talking to sex workers in India? Every single person in society looks down on them. They are the lowest of the low. At hospitals, the nurses won't even touch them. But they had the courage to band together and go to health facilities and demand their rights. They taught me that when women lock arms at whatever level in society, they can change the world. What's the ultimate goal? It's not the rise of women and the fall of men. This isn't about bringing women in and leaving others out. It's about bringing women in as a way to bring everyone in. Now, we just got a few seconds left. We'll end up with a few jokes. Question: why should you never date tennis players? Answer: love means nothing to them. Question: how do you weigh a millennial? Answer: in Instagrams. Ed, the same bike tries to run me down every single day. Fred, sounds like a vicious cycle. Well, that means we have run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity, and I hope that you will listen to us next week and that you've enjoyed today. I'm Florence Nash, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and this broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, do give us a call at 919-832-5138.